I'm Brian Tetta, executive producer of The View. It's Wednesday, and I'm here with Joy Behar. This is Behind the Table. All right, it is Wednesday. It's Joy Behar Day. Very excited to have you here, Joy.
Thank you.
On the show yesterday, you told the table that you were going through your belongings and you found an old photo of you with Eric and Lara Trump.
Right.
How could that possibly come about?
Well, first of all, you know, Donald Trump and I go back in this show.
Yes.
And Barbara, the whole thing, he was just in kind of a New York guy.
Right.
You know, who had a show.
Yeah, he used to be on all the shows. He was the guy you called when Regis wasn't available and you couldn't get anybody last minute.
He was doing The Apprentice and asked me to be on it. I didn't want to be on it.
Oh, I don't know. Have we talked about that? You were asked to be on The Apprentice?
Yeah. I said, no, I'm not interested.
Yeah.
And so he would be here, you know. I mean, at that point, I had Melania on my other show on HLN. She was hawking her jewelry.
Mm-hmm. And a little birtherism.
And a little with a touch of birtherism.
Yeah.
And then he came here and he'd say, thank you for having Melania on the show. And he was like a guy. He was inappropriate saying he wanted to date his daughter and all that stuff.
Yes. But you called him out in the moment.
I did.
Yeah.
But he was not a threat.
No.
And then I went to the correspondence dinner while Obama was still president.
Yes.
It was the one where he probably triggered Donald into becoming like the monster that he is now. So I did not know that he was going to turn into this, you know, anti-democratic philandering felon.
But you and Lara and Eric is still even.
So there we were. And there's photographers around or something. So, or maybe I asked to take a picture. I just don't remember.
You know what the event was? Do you remember that?
The correspondence dinner.
Oh, that's where it was. It was the actual correspondence dinner. All right. You probably thought it was funny to get a picture with him at that
point. Yeah. I mean, he was not the threat that he is now. Now I would not have to take a picture with anybody.
Right.
Remember, I went to his wedding to Marla.
Yes.
I met Tiffany when she was a baby. You know, I saw he. I have a picture which I took of him and Marla at Catch a Rising Star.
I even remember when I first started working here, there was a time where you ran into him at Radio City Music Hall for like Adele or something, right?
Well, Adele. They were having an Adele concert.
Yeah.
It was an inside concert. And I said, and there he is with Melania. And I knew him from the show. He knew me. And I said to him, what are you doing? You really want to do this? And he said, have you seen the poll numbers? You know, and that's where he was at. It's like suddenly he saw himself as possibly getting the nomination.
We had him on the show. He's only been here. I produced him many times in my old job, but he was only here once in the time that I've been here. And he was via phone in 2015 when this is after he came down the escalator and all that sort of stuff. And I remember in the process of trying to book him, I think the reason he agreed to call was because you were newly back to the show and he wanted to, you know.
I remember that call.
And Joy's back. And so I think he thought you'd be, I don't know why he would think you'd be friendly given his politics.
But I was friendly to him when he was on, he was on a satellite.
Yeah, yeah.
And I said, you know, something to him that was trying to like warn him,
don't go down this path.
You don't go down that path and he and that rabbit hole, which he went in down to.
And that was the last time he was here.
Yeah. But, you know, he has a narcissistic personality disorder and believes that, you know, only I can fix this type of thing. And so when I'd see him backstage when he was on here, he'd say, you know, George Bush is a disaster, thinking, I could be better than him. And so he tried to do it.
Melania guest hosted The View a couple times, I think.
I don't remember that.
It was early on.
All right. No.
Yeah. And I know Donald had for sure. We have an interesting text for you kind of along those lines. It says, hey, Brian, love the pod. Thank you. I haven't missed an episode. Thank you again. In honor of Doggy Day, I thought Joy might find it interesting to know that Trump is the only president not to own a dog.
I knew that.
Yeah. Does it say something about someone if they have no affinity with animals?
Well, do you remember when Romney was running, he used to tie the dog on top of the roof.
Yes.
So having a dog does not necessarily make you a great person.
Yeah, no, for sure. For sure. Son of
but
Sam.
I think that, you know, Trump strikes as the type of person who couldn't even have a plant because he doesn't know how to take care of anything.
Yeah. Well, apparently, I have a legal note here. The Trumps are the first modern first family to not have a pet of any kind. In 2019, he said at a campaign rally he would feel a little phony having a dog.
Oh, please.
I mean, I guess you respect them sticking by his beliefs.
He doesn't want anybody getting more attention than he does.
I think you're right.
You're walking down the street and everybody's looking at the dog.
Yeah. I don't know. Who's your favorite presidential pet? Do you have one that sticks to mind?
I'm around a long time. So, yeah. Like, what's his name?
Checkers?
Lyndon Johnson. Okay. No, Checkers, I was a baby. But Checkers was Lincoln. Was Lincoln.
Nixon.
That was Nixon's dog.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there's a famous Checkers speech where he talks about, you know, that his wife was wearing a cloth coat or something.
Right. So there you go. Having a dog doesn't make you immune to anything.
No, there's another example of it. I don't remember what the Kennedys had.
Mm-hmm.
But then Lyndon Johnson had beagles, and he'd hold them up by the ears.
Oh,
and
gosh.
People would turn on him for that.
I remember, as they should.
And then I don't know about the rest of them.
Also on the show yesterday, we spoke about how Travis Kelce, your favorite topic, was getting pushback for liking his friend's photo with Donald Trump in it. You all agreed that the people should leave Travis alone. How do you think people should handle their friends who disagree with them politically?
Politically?
Yes.
I don't have a problem with people who disagree with me politically.
But do you have any close friends that strongly disagree with you politically? Do you just not talk about it?
Yeah,
with
like
them?
I have these friends, more Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
And the wife, immediately when she saw Trump, she said, look at him. He's like Mussolini. So immediately she turned on Trump. She was a Republican.
Right.
So obviously that is not an issue for me to have a Republican friend.
Mm-hmm.
But if at this point, after all he has done and all of the women that he has insulted and whatever else he's done,
mm-hmm.
that you still think that he would be a viable candidate for the presidency? He can't even stay awake in the middle of his own trial?
Yeah.
You think he's going to stay awake in the Oval Office? What's going on in this world right now, in Israel, in Ukraine, in Hungary, in some parts of South America? It's a very complicated situation in this world. And you need somebody who's not only smart and moral and upstanding, but somebody who can stay awake.
I have a group of friends from high school that are on a text chain with me still, and there are many Trump supporters among them. Sometimes it gives me helpful insights into explaining
well,
hot topics here.
I don't mean that I wouldn't talk to people.
Right.
I want to talk to them.
Yeah.
Because I try to pick their brains, see what they're thinking. But I frankly don't have any friends because he's immoral and unethical. And the friends would have to be that way, too, if they supported that, seems to me.
Yeah. I just want to talk about football and stuff, but they occasionally bring things
well,
up.
Well, fine. But, I don't have the luxury of speaking about football since I don't know anything about it.
I know. We'll be back in a moment. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing? Is it running on high? Is it drained or somewhere in between? Sometimes life gets so busy and we forget to check in with ourselves. With social gatherings picking up, it's easy to spread ourselves thin. I've been thinking a lot about finding the right balance. How much socializing is just right for you? And how do you recharge? Maybe you're a social butterfly or someone who needs a bit more alone time. Therapy has been a game changer for many. It's not just about addressing major trauma. It's about gaining self-awareness, positive coping skills, and learning to set boundaries. It's about becoming the best version of yourself. So if you're considering therapy, why not give BetterHelp a try? It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire and you'll be matched with a licensed therapist. Plus, you can switch therapists anytime at no additional charge. Take care of your social battery, and if therapy is on your mind, BetterHelp is here for you. Cheers to self-discovery and a healthier you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/view to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/view.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts. Step into the world of Hollywood like never before with Melissa Rivers' Group Text podcast. Melissa, renowned for her red carpet expertise and storytelling prowess, invites you to join her and her famous friends for hilarious and heartfelt conversations. From discussing the latest binge-worthy TV shows, navigating the highs and lows of life, and dissecting celebrity fashion, there is never a dull moment. With exclusive stories from special guests like Chelsea Handler, Cheryl Hines, your favorite reality stars, and deep dives into intriguing topics like the Where is Wendy Williams documentary, This podcast offers an insider's look into the glitz and glam of Tinseltown. It's not just Melissa's podcast. It's a collective experience where you're invited to join the conversation. So if you've ever wanted a peek behind the Hollywood curtain, subscribe to Melissa Rivers Group Text Podcast now on your favorite platform. Get ready for laughter, tears, gossip. In other words, unforgettable moments that'll keep you coming back for more. Don't miss out. This is one group text you won't want to exit.
All right. We did a Q&A with our studio audience today, and I wanted to call back to a few of the comments on the questions we got.
Yeah.
One person asked if there's any celebrity that gives you goosebumps. Who did you say?
I said they're dead.
Who were they?
Now, look, when I was a child, mm-hmm. I revered James Dean.
Oh, sure.
Okay. He was my go-to. I had his picture on my wall.
Oh, you had like the poster.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. I was so into James Dean. And you know why? Because James Dean was harmless.
He was a rebel without a cause. How is he harmless?
Did you ever see that movie?
He's
sensitive. He cries.
Yes.
He's not vicious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's not sexual. He wasn't sexual.
Really? I think people would consider him sexual.
No.
No?
As a young girl, you didn't feel he was sexual. You felt romantically inclined towards him. See, now you just had one of your producers come in here and say she was an Elvis fan.
Yes.
Now, I also grew up with Elvis,
mm-hmm.
and I found him to be sexually scary.
Threatening.
Look, I was a Catholic girl.
Right.
I was a virgin. You know, I wasn't going to, like, I was not in touch with my sexuality yet at
all. So the hip thrusting was not for you?
None of that.
Yeah.
And he was just, he looked like he would be scary.
Yeah.
But James Dean did not. James Dean looked like a sweetheart, and you know.
So you never had a bad boy phase, really.
Bad boy? No.
No. So okay. So you like sensitive men.
I like quiet guys who are funny.
Okay. All right. Well, that makes sense. Steve's a quiet guy.
My ex-husband was like that too.
Yeah. All right. So no go with.
I can't think of any, like, was I attracted to Marlon Brando like that? No.
Like Schwarzenegger wouldn't be your kind of thing.
No. 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 I like him, though.
Yeah, but not to
date
him.
But that's not my type.
All right, so.
My type is the guy who needs medication.
Yes. There we go. Another studio audience member said she found love at 56 at a funeral. What did you think of this?
You know what happened? One time I was taking a class for directors and movie makers, and I was there as an actor.
Yeah.
And we shot a whole short play at St. John's Cemetery. It was written by Truman Capote, and it was about a woman who was looking for a husband. So she would go to the cemetery and see where the widowers were. And then she would come on to them. So this story reminded me of that. My point being that it's not a bad place to meet men. The widowers are there.
All right. So, but I mean, you got to give them some morning time, no? Although
they could be going and visiting after 2 years or 3 years or 5 years even.
I'm pretty confident my wife will show up with a date to my funeral. So I'm not too worried about that. And I guess, again, it's a good place to show your sensitivity. If you're a woman like you who likes a sensitive man, coming, mourning, sharing feelings, a little
weeping,
I'm not
really interested in depressed men anymore.
What about criers?
No more crying, depressions, no.
Okay.
My husband is very even-tempered.
Yes.
I can jump all around him. He stays steady. That's how I like it.
My wife also not particularly even-tempered, but I am. You know, you've known me a while.
Yeah,
I don't lose my temper.
I always say that. The way that you run the show is working because you are not emotionally demented.
No. Or at least I don't show it when I am. I try to internalize that. All right. Yet another guy in the audience today asked if he was too old to start comedy in his 40s. You've talked about this a lot. I think it's really great.
Yeah.
You started in your 40s. So what's your advice for someone who wants to get into comedy later in life?
You know, I always go by my calendar, which used to have a comment a day on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've learned many things from those one-a-day calendars, you know? Like one of them was, tell the truth and run. That was Yugoslavian saying. Another one was, do what you can with what you have where you are. And I believe the other one is you can never tell how far you will go in life if you don't care who gets the credit.
Oh.
Those are my three mottos. So do what you can with what you have where you are. Like if you're in, you know, Timbuktu or or Kansas or someplace, you know, that's not New York or Los Angeles or Chicago, find the local club to get where there has an open mic and get on stage every single time you can. They will let you. And it doesn't matter when you start. Rodney Dangerfield, he was an aluminum siding salesman. Mm-hmm. And then he chucked it away, found this hook, I don't get no respect, became a big sensation. Was it one of the few very, very funny people around?
I loved Rodney Dangerfield.
Hilarious.
Yeah, I'll still go back and watch stuff. Yeah,
wonderful. Yeah. That crowd, you'll never see them again. Don Rickles, you know, all these people, Jonathan Winters, and this guy.
Yeah.
And others. There were others. I like to watch those old clips.
I got to produce Don Rickles a bunch of times and just hearing the stories. And they were the same stories every time, but they were so good.
I worked with him.
I knew that a little bit.
Yeah.
Was that...
at Westbury.
Yeah. Was that fun?
Yeah. While I was on warming them up, he was in there drinking a half a bottle of gin or something. And Steve said to him, how can you go out there after you're drinking all this? He goes, I can't go out with it if I don't drink it.
All right. So I got to tell you. So when I used to do when he was on the Letterman show, he would have somebody that would prepare his vodka in the cup beforehand. But what I found out, and maybe this was just later in life, he just thought it was vodka. There was a very little bit in it. It was mostly water at
really?
The end. And his guy was giving him a very, very watered down drink.
Oh, so it's like Dumbo's feather.
I think so.
Oh.
He thought he was flying, but
he thought he needed the feather.
Yeah. It was such an honor.
If I even had a glass of wine or, if, God forbid, smoked a joint or anything, I could never go on stage.
I mean, I can't imagine doing it without any kind of help.
No. The minute you drink, you're off. You're off. I can't.
Don,
but they all did. Alan King, too.
Yeah.
Knocked down on, you know, some
gin. Rickles insulted me many times. My two favorites were, you know, he asked me where I grew up, and when I told him, he said, so you didn't have any money. So that was always nice.
Yeah.
And then one time after not seeing him for a while, he said, you know, how's the family? I said, oh, it's good. We're having a baby. And he grabbed my stomach. He goes, when do you do?
he was hilarious.
Oh,
and politically incorrect.
Always. Like, remarkably so.
For some reason, I think he would have survived this anyway.
Yes. Too funny not to.
Yeah.
Too funny not to. Now, when you made the decision at the age you did to finally pull the trigger and go on stage.
Yeah.
Was there an inciting incident? Was there one thing that said, like, okay, now I'm going to do it. I've been thinking about it for a long time, but this is what's going to make me do it.
Well, I lost my job as Good Morning America, and I had no money.
So it was for money, really.
It was basically financially triggered me because I was very insecure.
Yeah.
And I had ego issues. You know, I didn't want to be humiliated in public. But when you're broke and you've tried every other occupation, you just put all of that aside and you bite the bullet and you go out there and you take the slings.
So it was really to pay
Desperado,
the bills.
Desperado, baby. I was funny as a kid. I was funny as a teacher. I was funny at every job I had.
Mm-hmm.
I would be hilarious at parties. And I wasn't getting paid for it. I had no occupation. So I said, let me monetize this ability.
So I know you're not someone who believes in fate or anything like that, but if you didn't keep getting fired and failing, you wouldn't have found the success.
See, I don't believe in fate because that was my own doing.
Right. You think subconsciously
my
you were sabotaging yourself until you could
indeed.
Get... Yeah, and putting yourself in the position to do it.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really interesting, I think. All right, we have a listener call for you from Steven. Let's hear it.
My husband?
Different one.
Hi, I am a dancer and choreographer in New York. I'm also an Italian, born and raised from Brooklyn. And my question is for Joy. I love this podcast, by the way. Thank you so much for doing it. It keeps my car rides really, really fun. Joy, I am a choreographer and I'm starting to create my own shows and work in New York. I was just wondering, when creation becomes a job and not just a hobby, how do you find yourself still stay super motivated to create, even though you have a lot of pressure on you to deliver your best work in front of a live audience? Thanks so much.
So but basically what he's asking is, at a certain point, the thing you love, creating something, becomes a job. I'm sure for him.
Well, I just described how I did stand up out of necessity.
Mm-hmm.
Mother of necessity.
Does that take the joy out of it, I guess, is the question. Does that suck the thing that you love
about
it? It does. So he's asking, how do you stay motivated even when you have pressure on you like that in front of a live audience?
Because I had to. I had no choice. That's why if you have a choice, I would not recommend it. It's not the easiest job to do.
Right. You know, I mean, I'm the same way. I need the my back to be up against the wall. Yeah. I need a deadline. I need something to
a
really kind of kick me into
everything. Yeah. Well, then what would happen is I would call up, let's say, the improv and say, okay, these are my availabilities this week.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd say, okay, 2:00 Friday in the middle of the night, they'd give me. And then I'd have to show up because once I gave them that information, then I would go. If I didn't give them the information, I probably would have stayed home.
All right. But now something like the writing you're doing and the playwriting,
yeah.
That's something that you don't need to do. That's
no.
Something that you don't have pressure to do. This is something right. That's self.
That's right.
Yeah. That's coming from inside of you. So what makes that happen?
So I do it because I have a creative instinct.
Mm-hmm.
I must be creative. When I'm not working, I also paint a little bit. I like to do creative things.
Right.
I like to go to school. I like to take workshops. And so the creativity is what drives me, but without the panic.
But now the plays are maybe kind of inching into something where it will become work because you're trying to put them on stage.
Yeah, yeah.
Does that sap the fun for you or is it still exciting?
No,
that's great.
I find it fun. I find it so much fun. But being a stand-up is the only area that really makes me crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And I've stopped doing it because of that.
Do you think you'll never go on stage again or is there
no,
any chance?
I could do it. I could still get up there if I had to. But I don't want to be a headliner and have to do an hour and a half. I don't want to do it.
Right.
I'm alone up there. I did a one-woman show and I couldn't wait to be done with it.
All right. Thanks for joining me, Joy. Tomorrow, Sarah will be joined by ABC News chief meteorologist and climate correspondent and her good friend, Ginger Z. As a reminder, starting on Friday, Behind the Table will be on a spring break for a week, returning on Monday, April 29th. Tune in on Friday for an all-new episode of The View, and then we'll be airing some of our favorite Encore episodes next week. As always, check the episode description for the number to our Behind the Table hotline and give us a call or a text. Thanks for listening.
Step into the world of Hollywood like never before with Melissa Rivers' Group Text podcast. Melissa, renowned for her red carpet expertise and storytelling prowess, invites you to join her and her famous friends for hilarious and heartfelt conversations. From discussing the latest binge-worthy TV shows, navigating the highs and lows of life, and dissecting celebrity fashion, there is never a dull moment. With exclusive stories from special guests like Chelsea Handler, Cheryl Hines, your favorite reality stars, and deep dives into intriguing topics like the Where is Wendy Williams documentary, this podcast offers an insider's look into the glitz and glam of Tinseltown. It's not just Melissa's podcast. It's a collective experience where you're invited to join the conversation. So if you've ever wanted a peek behind the Hollywood curtain, subscribe to Melissa Rivers' Group Text podcast now on your favorite platform. Get ready for laughter, tears, gossip. In other words, unforgettable moments that'll keep you coming back for more. Don't miss out. This is one Group Text you won't want to exit.